Welcome to an excerpt of the CME activity, Addressing Residual Risk in the ACS Patient, Knowing the Numbers, which is certified by Medscape and presented by M. John Chapman, Ph.D., DSC, John J.P. Castelline, M.D., Ph.D., and Antonio M. Gatto, Jr., M.D., D.Phil. Dr. Chapman is the president of the European Atherosclerosis Society, director, Dyslipidemia and Atherosclerosis Research Unit, National Institute for Health and Medical Research, Hôpital de la Pitié-Salpêtrière, Université Pierre-Marie Curie, Paris, France. Dr. Chapman has disclosed the following relevant financial relationships. He served as an advisor or consultant for AstraZeneca Pharmaceuticals, Danone, Kowa Company, Merck & Company, and Pfizer. He served as a speaker or a member of a speaker's bureau for AstraZeneca Pharmaceuticals, Kowa Company, and Merck & Company. He received grants for clinical research from Kowa Company, Merck & Company, and Pfizer. Dr. Chapman does not intend to discuss off-label uses of drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics approved by the FDA for use in the United States. Dr. Chapman does not intend to discuss investigational drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics not approved by the FDA for use in the United States. Dr. Castelline is a professor of medicine, chairman, Department of Vascular Medicine, Academic Medical Center, University of Amsterdam, Amsterdam, the Netherlands. Dr. Castelline has disclosed the following relevant financial relationships. He served as an advisor or consultant for Anthera Pharmaceuticals, AstraZeneca Pharmaceuticals, Merck & Company, Novartis Pharmaceuticals Corporation, Pfizer, and Roche. He served as a speaker or a member of a speaker's bureau for AstraZeneca Pharmaceuticals, Merck & Company, and Roche. He received grants for clinical research from Anthera Pharmaceuticals, AstraZeneca Pharmaceuticals, Merck & Company, and Roche. Dr. Castelline does not intend to discuss off-label uses of drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics approved by the FDA for use in the United States. Dr. Castelline does intend to discuss investigational drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics not approved by the FDA for use in the United States. Dr. Gatto is a professor of medicine, Stephen and Suzanne Weiss Dean, Weill Cornell Medical College, New York, New York. Dr. Gatto has disclosed the following relevant financial relationships. He served as an advisor or consultant for AstraZeneca Pharmaceuticals, DuPont, Kowa Company, Merck & Company, and Vitera Healthcare Partners. He serves on the board of directors for Agerion Pharmaceuticals and Arisaf Pharmaceuticals. Dr. Gatto does not intend to discuss off-label uses of drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics approved by the FDA for use in the United States. Dr. Gatto does not intend to discuss investigational drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics not approved by the FDA for use in the United States. The goal of this educational event is to educate clinicians on the latest HTLC clinical trials in the prevention of atherosclerotic disease in at-risk patients. This activity is supported by Genentech. To participate in the CME activity, please go to medscape.org/features/audio and select the title.
Ladies and gentlemen, friends and colleagues, it's a great pleasure to share with you today an exciting and timely educational roundtable. I am John Chapman, current president of the European Atherosclerosis Society and director of the Dyslipidemia and Atherosclerosis Research Unit of INSERM at Hôpital de la Pitié-Salpêtrière in Paris, France. The focus of our roundtable is on the acute coronary syndrome patient, and more specifically on the residual risk in that patient. And we will be focusing down with two highly distinguished colleagues today on knowing the numbers, a critical aspect of the diagnosis and the treatment of the ACS patient. My distinguished colleagues are Professor Antonio Gotto, who is Dean and Professor of Medicine at the Weill Cornell Medical College in New York, and from across the pond, so to say, Professor John Kastelein, who's current Professor of Medicine at the Department of Vascular Medicine in the highly renowned Academic Medical Center of the University of Amsterdam in the Netherlands. So welcome, gentlemen, to this educational roundtable. We are going to be focusing on the clinical needs, the unmet need in the ACS patient, given the fact that there is general recognition of a high residual cardiovascular risk post-event in that patient group. And one of the particular features of the post-ACS patient are marked changes in the lipid profile, not only in LDL, but also in the potentially atheroprotective high-density lipoproteins. And we're going to be focusing down on HDL with Professors Gotto and Kastelein today. Now, the different points that we're going to cover are summarized in a series of seven questions, which I'd just like to run through with you now. The first, are the low HDL levels, which have been documented very frequently in ACS patients and in those with chronic coronary heart disease, are they really well documented? Do we have the evidence base that we need for that statement? Secondly, is there a change of any significance in HDL levels over the period of the acute phase during and post myocardial infarction? Thirdly, what is the evidence that low HDL cholesterol constitutes a major predictive risk factor for recurrent events in ACS patients, even on a background of intensive statin therapy? Furthermore, is such evidence restricted to males? Do we have an evidence base in females? Both critically important. Now, our field has moved forward to recognize that not only the amount of HDL, the amount of cholesterol it carries, but particularly the atheroprotective and vasculoprotective activities of HDL are particularly relevant to the protection of the arterial wall. And we would raise the question with you today as to whether or not any of the documented biological activities of HDL might be relevant to the pathophysiology of the clinical event in the acute coronary syndrome patient. Now, we're well aware that there is marked inflammation and an acute phase response during the time course of the acute coronary syndrome. And another question, which is timely, is that is it not only the level of HDL, but also the functionality of HDL, is that relevant, and might it be subnormal as a consequence of the inflammatory state in the ACS patient? So these are all questions which we will deal with and discuss with Tony and John. And then John particularly will move on to an unmet need which can be described as pharmacotherapeutic. So which mechanistic approaches to pharmacologically mediated HDL raising in ACS and in chronic coronary disease do we consider of greatest interest? And has our viewpoint been modified by the results which will be presented tomorrow at the American Heart Association in the context of the AIM-HI trial? A critically important question for all of us. And then finally, are prospective clinical trials ongoing to examine any of the questions that I've covered with you in this introduction? So let's move now to Professor Gotto, who will deal then with the question of the residual risk in ACS patients, knowing the numbers, with a particular focus on HDL. Professor Gotto.
Thank you. Thank you very much, John. John, I'm delighted to participate in this conference today. Well, first of all, on the subject of residual risk, if one treats patients who are having an acute coronary syndrome with a statin, what you do is reduce the risk over, say, a period of 2 years by 16 or 17%. But that still leaves behind another 14 or 15% risk that the patient will have an event in the group receiving the statin. So if you look at the area between the curves of those on placebo and those on statins and those below the statins, which shows the residual risk, the area under the curve who are on the statin is about five times greater than the size of the group that actually had reduced risk by receiving the statin. So it's a huge problem. This slide shows prevalence of low HDL in 136,905 patients hospitalized with CAD between 2000 and 2006 in the United States. This was part of the Get With The Guidelines program to try to get physicians and patients to treat patients more aggressively who had coronary artery disease. The lipid levels were measured within the first 24 hours. The mean HDL was approximately 40, and the HDL under 40 was present in 54.6% of the individuals in this particular study. HDL over 60 was 7.8%. So in this measure of categories, those who had HDLs below 40 were the majority in this group. There was a significant depression in mean HDL, interestingly, between 2000 and 2006, from 43 to 39 in the population measured. And this possibly was due to an increase in obesity and insulin resistance in the United States, both of which are associated with lower levels of HDL. Another large population study group, the CRUSADE study, 93,263 patients who had a non-ST elevated acute coronary syndrome. And in this group, 18% had very low levels of HDL. That's between 10 and 29 milligrams per deciliter. And 34.5% had low HDL between 30 and 39. The very low HDL cholesterol group was mostly strongly associated with male sex, lower levels of LDL cholesterol, and higher triglycerides, smoking, no treatment or use of lipid-lowering agents. They were of a younger age, had higher BMI, a higher incidence of diabetes mellitus. Very low and low HDL cholesterol was associated with an increase in left main disease and our triple vessel disease in this group of patients. And what the slide shows, the upper slide shows a shift to lower HDL levels in men versus women at the time of an ACS. Not surprising, but because before the menopause, men have lower levels of HDL, but it was true also in this group, and a linear decline in in-hospital mortality as the HDL level increased from 10 to 40 milligrams per deciliter. Now, this slide also is taken from data ACS patients who were presented, 109 patients who were at their targets for LDL cholesterol. And you can see on the left hand of the slide that those who were at optimal levels still had an HDL that was at a suboptimal level, that is less than 40 for men or less than 50 for women. So even those you see on the right, which shows non-HDL and two groups with LDLs less than 100 and less than 70, 75 to 86% were at their target for non-HDL cholesterol, but only a fraction of these, 17% and 15%, were at an optimal level of HDL cholesterol. Well, John referred to the changes associated with lipids and lipoproteins at the time of an acute myocardial infarction. You can see this on the four sections of this slide. Upper left and the two lower slides showing the decrease in LDL cholesterol and HDL cholesterol. These reach a nadir at about 7 days. And the only lipid fraction that increases is a triglyceride, which reaches a maximum just before 7 days. Now, these are typical changes of an acute inflammatory process. You see somewhat similar changes, for example, with an acute infection. The lipid seems to be driven into the macrophages. And so both LDL and HDL are low, as well as total cholesterol. This is one of the reasons why we advise measuring the lipids in the first 24 hours after admission with an acute coronary syndrome. Otherwise, wait until over a week after the acute event. But the triglycerides go up, the HDL goes down, and whenever you have this type of situation, you anticipate you're going to have an increase in the proportion of the smaller, dense HDL particles. Now, what happens when in a clinical trial in patients with stable coronary disease, you reach the target of an LDL under 70? Well, these data are taken from the Treat to New Targets trial, which was comparing 80 milligrams of atorvastatin versus 10 milligrams of atorvastatin. And what we see here that even when LDL cholesterol is under 70 milligrams per deciliter, the on-treatment level of HDL predicted the risk of these individuals. So having a higher level of HDL was protective in the TNT study, even when the LDL was less than 70 milligrams per deciliter. And this is a residual risk in three different trials. In the MIRACLE trial, which was acute coronary syndrome, administering 80 milligrams of atorvastatin at the time of the admission of the patient versus placebo, a 16% reduction in relative risk in the atorvastatin versus the placebo over a four-month period. The first trial to demonstrate that statin treatment acutely at the time of an ACS is a benefit. The PROVE-IT trial, which compared high-dose atorvastatin, 80 milligrams, versus 40 milligrams of pravastatin with an advantage to atorvastatin, also showed 16% decrease in events. But despite this decrease in events, there was still an event rate of approximately 16% in the people who had received the statin. So the residual risk is a very substantial problem. And in the A to Z trial, in which there was a delay after the acute event before simvastatin was administered, there was a positive trend, although it did not meet statistical significance. But in all these cases, despite the benefit of statin, there was a very significant residual risk. This shows the MIRACLE study. In the MIRACLE study, there was no relationship between baseline LDL and 16-week risk for death, MI, or unstable angina. But each 1 milligram per deciliter increase in HDL cholesterol reduced risk by an absolute value of 1.4% at 16-week period. There was a stronger protective effect of HDL when the baseline LDL cholesterol was below the median. Now, not every trial gives the same results, but there are differences in these trials. For example, in the PROVE-IT trial, the randomization was not until about 10 days after the acute event. At ACS, in the MIRACLE trial, the drug was given versus a placebo at the time of the event, and PROVE-IT was one statin versus another statin. In the PROOVIT trial, risk for death or acute coronary events was not related to the HDL level. It did not predict the two-year risk following an acute coronary syndrome. But again, remember, it was a later time after the ACS before the randomization, and one was not comparing the atorvastatin versus a placebo, but against another very effective statin. These data are taken from studies by Steve Nissen and Steve Nichols at the Cleveland Clinic using intravascular ultrasound. And what they show is that to get the optimal regression of atheroma in coronary artery patients, one needs to get the LDL down and have a higher level of HDL. And so the optimal reduction in plaque volume, or the optimal regression, was achieved by an LDL less than 87.5 milligrams per deciliter with a rise in HDL greater than 7.5%. The Coronary Drug Project, which was carried out in the 70s, over a 6.2-year period, treatment with niacin improved all of these various measures of coronary events, including cardiovascular surgery. And then 15 years after the trial started, or 9 or 10 years after the trial ended and the patients were no longer on drug, there was actually a statistically significant reduction in all-cause mortality. So in conclusion, low HDL cholesterol is common in patients with acute coronary syndrome. The acute phase of myocardial infarctions associated with decreases in HDL up to 30%, among other lipid effects, with triglyceride increasing, and HDL cholesterol levels generally return to the baseline within a period of about a month. Evidence from intensive statin trials is mixed regarding the predictive value of HDL cholesterol for recurrent events, but mind you, there were differences in the circumstances and in the drug use in the two groups in the studies reported. And finally, statins and niacin have shown positive effects on HDL cholesterol and also on imaging and clinical endpoints.
Thank you very much indeed, Tony, for this really comprehensive analysis of the data on lipid-related residual cardiovascular risk during the clinical course of the acute coronary syndrome, particularly as that risk relates to changes in HDL cholesterol and equally, of course, in triglyceride, which you pointed out, and we know that their metabolism is intimately related. Now, you mentioned the inflammatory dimension of the acute coronary syndrome, and this brings me, Tony, to the question of would you anticipate that not only are there changes then in the quantitative dimension of HDL and HDL cholesterol during the ACS time course, but might you predict that there would also be potentially deleterious changes in the function or the quality of HDL over that period?
Yeah, well, that's a very good question, John. I don't have data, I have not seen data about measuring the functionality of HDL during the acute event, although such data may exist. But based on studies of HDL and other inflammatory conditions, since the so-called good or more functional HDL tends to be used up, I would expect that the HDL present under those circumstances would be expected to be pro-inflammatory.
Thank you, Tony. So in a sense, we would agree, probably John too, that in the context of the ACS patient, we may need to think therapeutically not only about the amount of HDL, but potentially also of the efficacy of that HDL in protecting against plaque rupture, in protecting the wall of the vessel against the deleterious changes in lipid profile. So that actually leads me to your penultimate slide, in which you clearly showed that niacin is an effective agent, And favorably impacts cardiovascular endpoints, and certainly did in the coronary drug project. Now, as you indicated in our preceding discussion, this, in a sense, is potentially helpful and useful to the clinician, but there is, unfortunately, a sting in the tail. And the sting in the tail is, of course, as we're well aware, that despite the potential clinical usefulness of niacin, its use is associated with a significant adverse effects, which do, of course, affect compliance. And we are, of course, thinking about the flushing phenomenon. Now, this, of course, then raises a question which Professor Castelline will address, and that is, what agents are actually in the pipeline? Which agents are under development, John, which would be relevant to the ACS situation and might potentially not only favorably modulate HDL levels, but ultimately perhaps function? So, John, over to you.
Thank you very much, John. It's wonderful to be here among colleagues, and I will share some data with you. I can't exhaustively go into everything that's in development. In that sense, it's a wonderful time because there's no longer a paucity of these strategies, and I've lined them out on this slide. First, there are a number of drugs that inhibit cholesterol ester transfer protein, and I've stopped counting. I think there are more than five of those drugs currently in development. Then there is, as you were referring to, a combination of ER niacin with a drug that in fact inhibits the flushing, loropaprand, and that combination is coined Tradaptive in Europe. Then, of course, there are a number of ApoA1-based strategies. There are drugs that can upregulate the synthesis of ApoA1, and you can also infuse a pre-beta HDL-like particle, for example. LCAT, there is an LCAT replacement strategy in terms of protein therapy, and then there are a number of agonists for a protein that's called ABCA1, which is the cholesterol efflux pump that pumps cholesterol out of the macrophage. I cannot go into every detail, but I will definitely share a few exciting snippets of data with you. Now, we are all aware that the inhibition of CETP was, in humans, first started with a drug called torcetrapib, and that a very large trial called Illuminate, in fact, revealed that there was an increase in mortality from numerous causes. And the question was at that time, is this an off-target effect, or is this caused by CETP inhibition? And these elegant data here show, and in purple what you see is with increasing doses of torcetrapib, you see that the adrenal cell starts to produce aldosterone. Mm-hmm. Now, aldosterone is a very nasty molecule that's associated with an increase in water and salt retention and a lowering of potassium, and is something you don't want if you are at increased risk of cardiovascular disease. At the same time, in the slide, you see the yellow bars that even at very high doses of a novel CETP inhibitor called dalcetrapib, there's absolutely no increase in aldosterone production. Similar data are now generated for the other CETP inhibitor from Merck called anacetrapib. So we seem now to understand that the effects that were seen in the first large trial were indeed off-target effects that had nothing to do with CETP inhibition, and that gives us kind of the confidence to move on with the development program. Now, this is a somewhat busy slide, but this is the phase 2 summary of efficacy with dalcetrapib, where you can see that CETP activity is approximately 50% inhibited with the 900 milligram dose, and that there are HDL elevations of somewhere between 30 and 35% with some triglyceride reductions, but not much effect on LDL. So this is a, I would say, mild CETP inhibitor that is extremely well tolerated and is very safe until now in clinical development. Very interestingly, recently, an imaging study was published in The Lancet called DALPLUC. And DALPLUC was in fact done in 130 patients with established coronary heart disease and, of course, a plaque. And those plaques in the carotid were assessed both by PET-CT as well as by MRI. And I'm not going to again show you all the data because everyone can read this. This was led by Zahif Fayyad of Mount Sinai in New York. But what I will show you is just one slide, and these are individual data. This is the change from baseline in average carotid total vessel area. And total vessel area is kind of the parameter of these MRI studies that we consider clinically extremely relevant. On the left-hand side is placebo, and on the right-hand side is dalcetrapib. And it does not take a rocket scientist to assess that there is a definite difference between the two. So in my mind, this is one of the first indications at the plaque level that inhibition of CETP by a novel molecule that does not have the off-target effects of dalcetrapib is associated with a beneficial effect. Now, of course, these days we can no longer register a drug on the basis of an imaging trial. So there is a large program surrounding this drug called the DALHEART program, with DAL vessel, DAL outcomes, DAL plaque 1, DAL plaque 2, and there's even a DAL outcomes 2 right now. And so we will see within, in fact, the next 2 years or so, in a large ACS trial, importantly because that's what Professor Goto just discussed, whether CETP inhibition and HDL elevation in ACS will work. Now, the other one, anacetrapib, these are data in monkeys, and again, it's not hard to see on the right-hand side that there's no difference in blood pressure, and on the left-hand side, torcetrapib had a difference, so also anacetrapib seems a very safe drug, and what you can see here is that the HDL elevation goes up well into 130%, and LDL well down to 40%, so this is a very potent drug in terms of its effects on lipids and lipoproteins, and that drug is currently tested in a what I would call a humongous trial called REVEAL, TIMI 55, 30,000 patients, secondary prevention trial, and this trial is currently enrolling. So this will come after DAL outcomes and also will have to answer whether after an ACS, more chronic coronary disease, that CETP inhibition would be beneficial. Coming back to niacin and loropaprand, I think that when we realize that the addition of ER niacin at the 2 gram dose to a statin, that actually leads to impressive changes in lipids and lipoproteins. What you can see here is something like a 50% lowering of LDL, an almost 30% increase in HDL, and a 30% decrease in triglycerides. So together, those changes would, in my mind, be associated with a favorable effect on outcomes. Now, we also know that Aim High, in fact, that will be presented tomorrow, we already know that there was no benefit. Now, Aim High was a study in patients over 45 with different manifestations of CVD and dyslipidemia. They had to have low baseline levels of HDL and triglycerides somewhere between 150 and 400, and had to have an LDL below 180 off statin. Now, the design of Aim High, in my humble mind, is somewhat bizarre, because in fact, the randomization was to simvastatin 40 and ER niacin 2000, but at the same time, the placebo was not exactly placebo, because there was low-dose niacin to actually mimic the flushing also on the other side of the trial, and as well, it was possible to up-titrate the statin and add ezetimibe. And this resulted in almost no difference in LDL at the end of the day. And in fact, the addition of low-dose niacin in the placebo arm actually also led to an increase in HDL in the monotherapy arm. And in fact, the end difference in HDL was just 4 milligrams per deciliter. There was a small difference in triglycerides. So now we have a trial that is basically only revealing a difference in HDL of 4 milligram per deciliter, and even if you would be extremely generous, that would lead to at most a 10% difference in events, and of course a trial of somewhere between 3,000 and 3,500 patients is not powered to show a difference of that magnitude, and that's exactly what we are seeing here. The trial was prematurely stopped for futility and also for some a worrisome increase in strokes, but actually a lot of those strokes occurred long after everybody was off therapy. So this trial, it will be very interesting to see some of the details tomorrow in order to be a better judge. And I think that what I have on the screen here as the last of my slides is a design of HPS2 Thrive, which is the trial that actually randomizes patients that are at the beginning on high dose, no, I would say on robust statin therapy with or without ezetimibe, so everybody has the same LDL level, and then there's a randomization to ER niacin with the anti-flushing agent or placebo, which in my mind is a superior design to aim high. Not only that, this trial was powered at 25,000 people instead of 3,500. So I think that we will really have to wait until we have the results of HPS to Thrive before we have any judgment on ER niacin as an agent that can reduce heart attacks. And with that, I think I've kind of, at a helicopter level, have shown you some of the developments that are currently there with drugs that raise HDL cholesterol. Thank you, John.
Thank you very much indeed, John, for these absolutely pertinent and insightful comments on the ongoing R&D programs around HDL-raising agents. Now, there may be some confusion in our audience today in the sense that clearly the CETP inhibitors, niacin, much of the data, the recent data in the literature suggests that there is efficacious HDL raising, and equally from Alan Toole's work, that the particles that are the HDL particles that are induced under the effect of these agents are actually functional and may indeed exhibit enhanced function. So in that respect, we can be optimistic, certainly, with respect to these trials. But on the other hand, as you ably discussed, John, we have AIM High, for which we don't have all the data, but you certainly emphasize the small net increase in HDL, and equally the fact that the size of the population is substantially underpowered. Now, there is another question that's perhaps concealed here, and that is, if we have an agent that raises HDL to a relatively small degree, as in this instance, in this particular design, so that the net increase that was niacin induced was reduced, the question, of course, then becomes, how long should we have run the trial? Because one of the difficulties we have, we really don't know the time course required for the expression of the different potential positive effects of HDL and LDL. So what's your, would you like to just comment? It's a very difficult area, John, but would you like to come in on that and comment?
John, I think you actually raised a very important point, is that there's very elegant data from Ulf Landmesser's group in Zurich, just published in JCI, that have shown that the abnormal dysfunctional HDL that you see in chronic CHD is in fact improved by nicotinic acid. So not only CETP inhibitors are now associated with an improved functionality, but also ER niacin or nicotinic acid. That's the first observation. The second observation that you raised is that it takes time. What, you know, the word function kind of requires time. So it might have been that in fact aim high was too short, that it takes longer for the curves to diverge. And last, I would say, the Oxford group is not the least in the world in terms of trials, and they came up with a sample size of 25,000. AIM High came up for the exact same scientific question with a sample size of 3,300. So, I mean, who's right? I mean, I don't think it's very hard to answer that question. So, unfortunately, AIM High is not the final answer to the question whether, on top of statin therapy, ER niacin will improve cardiovascular outcomes.
Thank you very much, John, for those insights. Let me thank both Professor Gatto and Professor Castellin for their elegant and comprehensive analyses of the database relating to residual cardiovascular risk in the setting of the acute coronary syndrome. There is a major unmet need. Clearly, a number of promising new pharmacotherapeutic approaches are ongoing. The appropriate morbid mortality trials have been launched, and we can anticipate results from those trials within the next 2 to 4 years approximately. So we are in an exciting configuration in the field of lipid disorders and premature cardiovascular disease, which they so deleteriously impact. I'd simply like to say then, ladies and gentlemen, friends and colleagues, watch this space. The future is promising and it will be exciting. Thank you very much on behalf of my highly distinguished colleagues, Tony and John. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this excerpt of the CME activity, Addressing Residual Risk in the ACS Patient, Knowing the Numbers. To participate in the CME activity, please go to medscape.org/features/audio and select the title.